This is the Education Gadfly Show.
No, those kids, though, they... Sometimes you're not even sure where you're going, and you're just like, you come to a fork, and it's just a wall.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli, of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show, and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, a man who needs to bridge some differences with Deborah Meyer, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mike, how you doing, babe?
So, Rick, this is legendary now, this exchange that you had at your conference with Deborah Meyer. What happened?
You know what? We've been doing this for a long time, and we've always had speakers who kind of respect the fact that we've explained up front in advance how long they should speak, and that we try to run events where we make sure that they're tightly run and everybody gets into a constructive conversation. Mm-hmm. We had a situation where we had an invited participant who seemed not to be crazy about working within those constraints.
You know, I think what this shows is that you need some kind of bouncer at AI. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just not right for you to have to be the one up there trying to get her off the stage. You need the old hook to just whoosh, mm-hmm. and she's off.
You know, usually has it come up. Usually, you know, we've had 150, probably 200 people speak, maybe more since I've been, certainly more than since I've been at AI. And I don't think we've ever before run into that situation. Usually, you know, a firm look from a Whitney or a Jenna holding a time card, and most of these folks kind of quickly subside.
You know, Joe mentioned that we wanted to use your tirade on the show maybe, and I thought, oh, he's talking about the blog post you had this morning about Arne Duncan. But no, you've had so many tirades lately, Rick. I can't keep track. So let's hope that you have some more tirades on this show. That's what we're all listening for.
Tightly wound, baby.
Lots to cover. Let's start with Pardon the Gadfly. Daniela, get us started.
Okay, and actually talking about Arne Duncan, he upped the ante for an ESEA re-auth this week as he signaled that he would waive the state's 100% proficiency requirements and also attach new reform requirements to those waivers. Do you think this approach will work?
I'm not sure what work means in this context. If work is, can Duncan impose the kinds of changes he happens to think would be good for schools, I'm sure we can get a little traction here. Problem for him is that American government is not a toy for people who happen to be appointed administrative office. It's a democratic process with checks and balances, legislative supremacy, and as much as he might find it frustrating, he's actually not entitled to unilaterally impose the kinds of reforms that he happens to think are good on states.
So look, he's got waiver authority. He doesn't have make up new mandate authority. Mm-hmm. And this is the distinction, is that if he just wants to waive some of this stuff, he does have waiver authority, and he can do what Margaret Spellings did with the growth model pilot program and say, hey, you know, if you want additional flexibility to do some things that the law doesn't quite allow, I will waive the parts of the law that are keeping you from doing it. But to then say, and if you want these waivers, you have to promise to do stuff we want you to do that isn't found in any law, but is just stuff we kind of dreamed up, then you're in some serious constitutional problems.
This is what folks seem to be missing, is that they're saying, well, geez, doesn't he have the right to issue waivers? Of course he does. The question is he able to start imposing extra statutory strings because he happens to think they are good reformy ideas as a price for waivers? And he absolutely does not. I don't know any theory of democratic governance or a constitutional interpretation that would imagine he has such authority.
So here's where this is going to come out. I think in the end they'll come out with their regs, and the most they'll be able to say is that states have to show that they are faithfully implementing No Child Left Behind. And there could be some pieces of that you know, they'll be stringent on. And if they meet those requirements, then they can get the flexibility. They can't go beyond it. I just don't understand. There'll be a lawsuit. Any regs they come out with will be sued to high heaven.
You know, what's really interesting is they are pushing, when they talk about doing this in terms of using it as a way to push their data system, desires, their teacher evaluation agenda, the Common Core, they risk actually, you know, creating a lot of backlash among the Tea Party and conservatives on this stuff, among folks who would have otherwise been disinterested or been their allies.
Yes. I will say, it is frustrating that Congress can't seem to get its act together. I mean, to me, there's a clear path forward on reauthorization, and particularly, you got to give it to the Senate. It's like, come on. You know, what's going on over there? The House, you know, they've got new members, the Tea Party thing, they're trying to sort things out. But in the Senate, just come out with something that looks a lot like the blueprint and get on with it.
But the House won't sign off on that, thank God.
Well, I think if it's a lot like the blueprint minus some of the more onerous stuff. I mean, look.
Then the administration won't sign off on it.
Well, who cares? The administrations will sign off on anything. They just want the thing done. Just come out with a bill. That's all I'm saying.
Well, I don't see why. Why is many bills are worse than their predecessors? I am fine with nothing happening.
All right. What if what if something comes out that more or less rolls back NCLB?
Oh, that'd probably be pretty amenable.
Yeah.
But I don't think the administration is real interested in that.
Yeah, I think.
And I don't think Harkin's interested.
I think they would take it. Okay, Danielle, topic number two.
Okay, moving on. State Line's Josh Goodman argued earlier this week that school districts are running out of ways to absorb cuts without affecting what takes place in the classroom. If this is true, where do we go from here?
But it's not true.
But it's not true.
Okay, topic number three. Just kidding.
Good talk, guys.
I mean, it's not true, right? I mean, look, it depends. I mean, look, are there some places, some particular school districts that for whatever reason have been seeing year after year cuts? There's, you know, there are some of those out there. I can imagine they've already, you know, had salary freezes. They've already asked teachers to pick up more of the health care bills. They've already raised class sizes in classes where class size is not as important. Sure. Then I you know, it might be some places out there where there's going to be some tough, really tough decisions. But most places still have not had to do this.
I mean, it's actually, I mean, it's not even starting to get ugly yet. I mean, it's now, you know, Shiller came out over the weekend, the Case-Shiller Index, Shiller, and he said that he actually thinks property values might decline another 5 to 25% over the next 5 years. Best case is, you know, Steve Moore, the Wall Street Journal, was saying today that, you know, you're probably seeing a bottom in property valuation next year. Commercial real estate the year after that. So, you know, a quarter to a third of school revenues come from property taxes, and you're going to have a ground, and you've got a lagged assessment of 2 to 3 years. So you're looking at a downward pull through 2015, 2016. You know, the stimulus is running out. Medicaid, health care reform is going to put substantial new Medicaid obligations on states. So, I mean, districts and superintendents and principals have been busy whining and rubbing their eyes about how tough all this is. And things haven't even really started to get tough yet. It's going to get worse. And for them to suggest that turning down thermostats, realigning bus routes, and delaying textbook procurement kind of exhausted their toolkit, and everything else is going to come out of the hides of kids, is just irresponsible management.
Well, they will say, look, we've signed on to these contracts. We can't do anything until the contracts are up again.
It's time for them to start calling the lawyers.
Yep. Like that. Whew. Look at that. That's a good line. I like that, Rick. It's time to start calling the lawyers. By the way, maybe those lawyers could work on the whole ESEA thing, too, and explain to Arnie Duncan why he can't make stuff up.
No, no, no. See, that Arnie is not afraid to get creative legal advice from his GC, apparently.
It's true. Okay, topic number three.
So, Rick, you've got your EdWeek blog Straight Up, and recently on Straight Up, you posted a blog post calling out Salman Khan as being the most overhyped education entrepreneur around. Why? And, Mike, do you agree?
Sure. You know, first off, is one of the problems with this stuff is either you're supposed to be in favor of what these folks are doing, or you're supposed to be opposed to it. And if you favor what they're doing, you're supposed to say nothing but nice stuff. And if you're opposed to it, you're supposed to accuse them of all kinds of villainy. Look, what he is doing is neat. I think the Khan Academy is a cool idea. They've got 2,100 plus lessons up at this point. I've seen some of them. I think they're really cool. I think he's clearly a really smart guy. Puts together great lesson plans. What I'm troubled by, and this came up when I was up at UPenn for the Nest conference last week. What I'm troubled by is the notion that this is the future of education. He's on the Colbert Report. Bill Gates apparently is out flacking it. The problem is basically what he has done is he has put a bunch of good lectures on YouTube, and that's good. And that's fine, and it's a useful and necessary part of moving schools forward, but it's not a solution. Instead, it's 1%. It's one good thing that we should have been doing 5 or 10 years ago, and that I think it's terrific that he's doing it, but I worry that somehow he becomes an oracle or the face of educational improvement because he has done one smart thing.
I would disagree that he's the most overhyped education entrepreneur. I think you got to give that to Joel Rose at School of One. And I like Joel and I like School of One. But, you know, it's in, what, 3 middle schools right now?
Mm-hmm.
You know, early going, I don't think much in terms of results. I mean, I think it's got a lot of promise and I think the customization. But again, it's so early. It's basically a concept that they're tooling around with right now. And we all talk about it again, like, oh, well, they've figured out blended learning. And this is it. This is the future. This is how we're all going to learn math.
You know, I mean, the frustration here, that's right. And you know, other names got mentioned or other operations that I and I think all of us here like. Rocket Ship Academies got mentioned when we were talking about this. Look, the problem is that there's this whole winning American Idol phenomenon to at innovation. That every time somebody, a medical device maker, comes up with a new stent valve, we don't see them on Colbert Report. or getting talked about on Jon Stewart or being asked to keynote. Now, this is just part of what you do. You come up with slightly better ways to do the business at hand. In education, though, every time somebody comes up with an interesting idea, instead of treating it as a healthy and natural step forward, instead of being patient, instead of being appropriately skeptical, we turn them into a overhyped kind of fad so that we can then all slouch away when they don't live up to this ridiculous overselling.
Yeah, but you know, we make a big deal out of innovation in other areas. I mean, the iCloud comes out and there's a lot of buzz, and you know, so I think that's somewhere between a medical stint and the iCloud. Okay, that's all we got for right now. That's like so many jumbled analogies. I just can't keep track of them all in my own head. Well, it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you much. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you. You know, Rick, when people go overtime, you know, people like, say, Deborah Meyer, he gets really angry at them. He starts to yell at them. And I just want to point out that I have not yelled at you for going over your minute allotment for a long time.
Have you been timing me every week? I did not realize that.
No, actually, I don't have a watch anymore now that I have an iPhone.
All right. Well, maybe I've gone, 90 seconds once in a while, but usually I'm pretty good.
Well, what you got for us this week?
This week, we have results from the new NAEP History Assessment. This is a 2010 report, just came out this week. It was last administered in 06. As most of our listeners know, this is a nationally representative test. It's test kids in 4th, 8th, and 12th grade, designed to measure their knowledge of American history as it relates to our democracy, economy, and changing world role. Anyway, here are the takeaways. The lowest achieving students and minorities made great gains. That's sort of the big headline. For instance, from 94 to 10 to 2010, 4th graders scored at the 10th percentile posted a 22-point increase, which is kind of a big deal for those at the bottom. At grade 8, scores for Black and Hispanic students rose since 2006. At both grades 4 and 8, low-income students recorded higher average scores in 2010 than in both 2001 and 2006. Average scores for 8th graders rose, resulting in the highest score yet in 2010, and average scores for 4th graders rose since 06, but not statistically significant. Still, let's put this into a little bit of perspective. It's not all good news. 12th grade, as usual, pretty flat, not significantly different from 06. Only 12% of seniors and 20% of 4th graders scored at least proficient. Further, more than half of all 12th graders scored below basic. I was listening to Diane Ravitch this morning. She was talking about how our history achievement lags results for for math, reading, science, civics, writing, geography, basically everything that we test, that the history is really low in terms of percentages of students scoring at proficient or advanced.
Well, lots to talk about. Let's dig in. Okay, now first of all, these promising results for lowest achieving and minority kids, tracks what's happening on the reading scores as well. Right? We've seen big improvements for those groups, and the biggest improvement seemed to be in the late 90s, early 2000s. What's hopeful is that, you know, there's been some question, like we started, there's something weird about the NAEP reading test that showed these huge spikes in improvement. It's kind of been corroborated.
Okay.
It's been corroborated by these data, which is not a reading test per se, but you would assume that if kids can read better, they're going to A, learn more history, and B, be able to do better on a history test because they can read the test.
Yeah, and that's another point that Diane made this morning. I was listening to the webinar. And where she said, you know, this could be about reading gains much more than history. And then I was reading some more commentary on it. And apparently, NAEP got a lot of survey results as well in terms of time spent in various, instruction. And 45%, I jotted this down, 45% of 4th graders had teachers who spent more than 2 hours a week on social studies. It's not as if 4th graders are getting a ton of, of social studies instruction. Mm-hmm. So it could very well have something to do with reading. They learned to read.
Yeah, because we do have data from other sources that does show at least some, some declines. I mean, it was never a lot to begin with in the elementary grades spent on social studies, but that it's gone down some. Okay, let's think about this a second. Okay, the 8th graders, they are 13-year-olds about, right? So when would they have been, say, kindergartners? It would have been about 8 years ago,
right?
So that about 2002, 2003, right, as No Child Left Behind and Reading First was really gearing up. I mean, I don't know. Yeah. I think that there's some reason to believe
that some of those reforms, yeah, reading first stuff, and in the late 90s, early 2000s, focused on scientifically based mm-hmm. reading instruction really is paying off for those kids.
I think it's a reasonable hypothesis. I mean, that's what some folks are saying about RTI, you know, that's tied to, you know, some really strong reading interventions, you know, in terms of the how we're looking at, you know, students with learning disabilities and the, you know, the decreases we've mm-hmm. seen there. So I think there's something to be said. You know, reading first was obviously, you know, huge initiative there. And I know when I was at Westat and was doing some reading first evaluations that, people on the ground will tell you this is making a difference, you know, by concentrating on these, you know, phonemic awareness and phonics and all these things. So,
right. Now, the 12th grade scores, I never know what to make of these 12th grade scores. Mm. I mean, one assumption is that the kids just aren't trying hard on the test. I mean, is that the answer? Or are really all, I mean, otherwise, it just seems like everything we're doing in the K through 12 system just washes out for those kids.
12th grade. I wish I had a hypothesis there. I just don't. Yeah, I mean, senioritis, I mean, hey, I mean, that's what people seem to think, but I just don't know.
Because more really kids are taking and passing the U.S. History AP exam.
Right.
Right now, that's a minority of the kids, but still.
Yep.
What to make of it? I guess I'm just in a mood this week where I want to believe that progress is being made. Otherwise, it's all just too depressing.
Yeah, I mean, there was this other little finding that was interesting that, and I forget which grade, where males were, you know, really outscoring females, and they were asking, you know, these panel of experts what they were making of that, and some folks were saying, well, there's a lot of war, you know, in history, and boys like to study war and fights, and I'm like, okay, I mean, I just think it's funny because we all just come up with these hypotheses, and you know, NAEP just can't answer these types of questions.
We don't have
a clue. You know,
but we did find, our reviewers have found, that the NAEP history framework is very good, and that it tests solid content stuff you'd want kids to know. So, you know, the fact that we know that most kids are not proficient in history, that is disturbing. Okay, so what goes along with this?
All right, the past couple weeks, you have not been happy with my songs. I've kind of picked up on that, so I'm hoping.
I mean, your 6 degrees of separation between your
the welcome back Carter and the gifted kids last week. So since we're talking history, we've got lots of historical references in Billy Joel's "We Didn't Start the Fire."
Harry Truman, Doris Day, Regina, Johnny Ray, South Pacific, Walter Winchell, Joe DiMaggio, Joe McCarthy, Richard Nixon, Studebaker, television, North Korea, South Korea, Marilyn Monroe.
So, Rick, how many more days until Bad Teacher comes out?
Oh, man, I think we're at about a week, 2 weeks maybe.
Yeah, very exciting. You're going to organize a field trip?
I think so. You guys in?
I'm in. Hopes sound high. You think this is going to be a breakthrough movie?
You know the plot.
Yeah. You've explained this. Yeah. I say it again. This is...
Cameron Diaz is a not great teacher who apparently with both alcohol and drug addictions who wants to get some plastic surgery and is unmotivated as a teacher until she finds out that the teacher whose kids show the biggest gains on the student on the achievement test wins a cash bonus, which will cover her elective surgery.
I hope in the credits that they credit, you know, some of us who've been pushing for merit pay all these years. Okay, it is now time for some people's favorite, Chris Irvine's What's Up With That?
I woke up this morning and I got out of bed, had a big old cup of coffee to clear my head. Telephone rang and you wanna chat? Well, sit on down and tell me what's up with that. What up with that? Yes,
Chris, just teasing you, though. I'm not sure who those people are.
Thanks for the plug, Mike.
All right, what you got for us this week?
All right, well, ask anyone who's been in school since the mid-1980s, and they can probably recall an encounter of one kind or another with the DARE program. DARE, an acronym for Drug Abuse Resistance Education, is an international education program that seeks to prevent the use of controlled drugs, membership in gangs, and violent behavior. Students who enter the program sign a pledge not to use drugs or join gangs and are taught by local law enforcement about the dangers of drug use through an interactive in-school curriculum. But in 1998, the program failed to meet federal guidelines that they be both research-based and effective, thereby disqualifying them from receiving federal grant money. But here we are, over a dozen years later, and the program is still being used in over 80% of schools. What's up with that? What really grinds my gears is that the annual operating costs are pegged at over $1 billion for DARE. While it no longer receives federal grant money, it has continued to receive funding from the Justice, Defense, and State Departments, as well as the DEA, in addition to funding from state legislatures and other local government sources. Scientific studies in 1995 and 97 showed the program is ineffective in reducing the use of drugs and could possibly even be counterproductive, as suggested by studies in 92, 94, 98, and 2003. In 2001, the Surgeon General placed DARE on the category of does not work, and in 2007, the program was placed on a list of treatments that have the potential to cause harm in clients, according to a journal, Psychological Science. Even in the face of all these facts and studies, the program continues to thrive in a good majority of our schools because, like many government programs, it gives the perception of effectiveness. Official police officers wearing official uniforms accompanied by displays and following a curriculum. As long as it sounds good, Americans will keep buying it.
Woo, nice. I like that one. Yeah,
good. You know, two things that actually jump out. One is I have always found it interesting that it's DARE, because you would think that we don't want schools just to teach kids not to abuse drugs, but you might actually want to teach kids not to use drugs at all. So it could just be drug resistance ed. Mm-hmm. I've never known quite what to make of that.
Dre.
Then you could get Dre. Then you could have Dr. Dre.
He's not associated.
Well, there's also the problem of that. I mean, the idea that, you know, I dare you, you know, to smoke this joint. I mean, you just don't want that associated.
But then the other part that's funny, the counterproductive piece, is I always thought it was kind of funny that you would have these cops go in with their sample cases and the rest and be like, okay, kids, here is absolutely, you know, here's what it looks like when you smoke a bowl. Here's what it looks like when you inject. And here's why it's a bad idea. You know, I'm not sure that actually giving kids step-by-step how-to guides is necessarily the most conducive way to make sure they don't start using.
So, I mean, you could look, you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to see what's going on here. I mean, all these government agencies, you know, all these people who work in government agencies whose jobs would go away if the drug problem disappeared overnight. So they spend $1 billion to try to keep the drug problem going, people. You hear what I'm saying?
Ooh, talk about a stimulus program.
Mm-hmm. You don't see DARE in those fancy private schools where, the wealthy and elite kids go, do you?
No, those kids, though, they... You know, sometimes you're not even sure where you're going, and you're just like, you come to a fork, and it's just a wall.
Well, that's all the time we have for the show. Until next time.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.